Hey, do you have an idea for a podcast but don't know where to start? Or do you have an already existing podcast that you want to take to the next level? Well, check out WeKnowPodcasting.com. From concept development to theme music to editing to logos, WeKnowPodcasting.com is a one-stop shop for all things pod. Don't hesitate to hit us up. We're very nice.
Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of Horror Movie Night. This week, we are without Kyle, we're without Brian, but we have a Nate Lopez in the house from 91 Donkey Lane.
Bump, 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 bump.
And we gave him the chance to pick a movie, and he gave us a couple solid options, but he had stressed that his top option was, in fact, In the Mouth of Madness, a movie that I think we've almost talked about on three different occasions on the show.
Yeah. So this one was basically, you're giving me a gimme because I almost picked this at least three times.
Oh, nice.
I think this is like one of those movies that I don't watch that often, but I always enjoy when I do sit down and watch it. I don't want to take anyone's double feature right out the gate, but I'm going to say it, of the apocalyptic trio of movies.
Apocalypse trilogy, Matt. You got to use it right or else somebody's going to come after us.
That's true. So, Scott, remind me what the third one is. Is it They Live or The Thing?
It's The Thing, Prince of Darkness, and then In the Mouth of Madness.
Okay. I'm not going to say this is better than The Thing, but...
I think. Shit. Now, oh no, Matt. What if I said the wrong thing?
But I will say that as much as I like Prince of Darkness, I think I like this one more.
Well, I think that this one is...
It's more bombastic. I think that that's
the phrase
we like to
throw. Yeah, but it also makes more sense, which is a lot to say. You know?
That is shocking, because this movie doesn't make sense.
Now, Scott, you've read more of these books than I ever have. Mm-hmm. It is my impression that this is like one of the most heavy H.P. Lovecraft-inspired films out there. There's clearly Cthulhu-like monsters, and then like people getting possessed by the works of an artist and all that. Like, this is pretty Lovecraftian by definition.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Beyond being a very Lovecraft film, it blends a lot of Stephen King into it, which is an interesting addition as well.
They're making interesting parallels, I think, between the two authors. You know, they're putting them on the same level clearly all the way through. It's very interesting, I think.
Which I feel like is a disservice to Stephen King, because Stephen King is a far less problematic writer than Lovecraft.
Not a racist psycho.
He just likes drugs a lot, or liked drugs a lot.
He likes drugs and car hand jobs. Man on man hand jobs in cars. Uh-huh. Man, does he love it.
And about 30,000 words too many.
I'm almost done Dr. Sleep. It's been a 2-month excursion to finish this book.
Yeah. I have not finished a Stephen King novel. I've tried and failed. Yeah. Probably for the last 15 years. I think that I was in college the last time I finished a Stephen King novel. So at least 15 years, if not longer.
I think the last one I read was Bag of Bones. That might have been like friggin' 1998, 99.
Yeah, I tried to read 11/22/63. I got a third of the way in because that book is about as thick as my forearm. It's ridiculous.
So I know there's always like the debate of like Stephen King versus Joe Hill. And I'll say the biggest point in the Joe Hill bucket is that Joe Hill rewrites his story three times until he can get it down to the bare essentials of what the story needs to be told, versus I think every Stephen King for the last 30 years has been the first draft.
Well, he rewrites it to add more in. I mean, can we do that to The Stand?
Yeah, he's like, man, so I only wrote 1,100 pages. I better add another 200.
There's some Joe Hill books that are legit, 300 pages, and, every fucking page of that book counts. But he's the first draft was, 800 pages. That's crazy. I had to rewrite it in, comb it down to like what the story needed. And I'm like, man, can you teach that to your dad? Because like,
yes,
I don't need these 1500 page books that say nothing for 1,000 of those pages.
Honestly, it's really going back to that 1122. Yeah. If you read the first chapter and then read the last chapter, you got the whole gist. You're
fine. Oh, yeah. Man. Well, then I can just, I can sell this book as soon as I'm off the podcast. It's for the day.
Scott, you should legitimately read the first chapter, read the last chapter, and engage in conversation with people who've read the book and see if they ever catch on that you didn't read the middle.
Here's the thing. What you're confusing me with is someone who wants to talk about a Stephen King book with strangers.
Join a book club, suggest that book.
There you go.
Do your bit and then quit the book club.
This is such a long con, but
it's like not,
the payoff will not be worth it. So
yeah, I don't think that as much as well as Matt knows me, he knows me so terribly because like I am the least long con person. So my wife and I, when we were dating, we had been talking about getting married. You know, I knew a ring size, all this business, and I had the ring forged in the fires of Mordor, got the phone call that said that it was ready. So I drove to the town that's like 40 minutes from my town where I had it made. I picked it up and I immediately drove an hour out past our house to where her grandparents were. And so I call her on my way out to the other town and I'm like, oh, I'm going out to that town for an errand. And she like fucking knew because I'm an idiot. And I didn't give her the details, but I gave her a detail and she figured it out. But so anyway, I have this ring in my pocket. I'm like, hey, do you want to go take a walk? I got this ring burning in my pocket. And I get down on one knee and she goes, are you really doing this right now? And I'm like, oh God, is she going to say no? But I got to say that the long con is not my thing because I could have waited a week. I could have waited a month. I mean, I could have found the opportune time, but I was just literally like, do you want to go take a walk? You know? And I was like, anyway, right, so
maybe we should talk about the movie.
Madness. Yeah.
So, I mean, there's not much you could do to add on it, but man, do I love this like heavy metal theme song that kicks off this movie right out the gate.
It's so good. I can watch them just printing that book, playing that song for hours. It was incredible.
You actually did. That was the whole movie.
Yes. Just that for a loop. You think that Sam Neill's in this, but you'd be wrong. But then also, like, you know, we're throwing Lovecraftian around, but I'm going to also throw the word Hitchcockian around.
Yeah.
Because that opening scene with the dude with the axe is like a perfect Hitchcock tension moment where it's like you're watching two characters who have no clue what's about to hit them, but you are watching and you're like, shit's about to go down in the worst kind of way right now.
Yeah, we actually commented. I hadn't seen this movie since I was a kid. This was one of my favorites as a teenager, and I'd totally forgotten about that opening. So when it comes on, Bacon and I were watching. He's like, what, nobody's going to care about the Axeman in the back? Like, hang on a minute, man. It'll come.
Is that going to be his cut up this month?
It might be. Yeah, I've got some. Yeah, when we get to the later points in this movie, I'm going to point out some stuff here that he was talking about too.
I honestly don't have a ton of notes because I really just got sucked into this film. It is a practical effects whirlwind of moments, both good and bad. Some effects look incredible, and some effects look passable.
The best part about it is that like the most quote unquote passable of them is definitely the innkeeper's wife with the tentacles, you know?
Yeah.
And originally that was going to be a full body suit. They shot it and it looked so bad that they changed it to a miniature and it's still not good.
I have a hard time with a lot of the miniatures in this movie. The one where the miniatures are running down the tunnel.
That wasn't miniatures.
That wasn't. Oh my goodness.
ILM did the special effects for this movie. And they actually, it was an 18-foot tall wall of monsters. And it was on a track that had, so there were people in it who were like moving around and stuff. And then there was also people, there were people behind it who were pushing it towards the people. I mean, I originally thought that it was claymation, stop motion, but it's people.
Oh,
I would also put on the passable category, and it's a great effect, don't get me wrong, it's a great effect, but when she's all twisted up and her head's upside down and she's spider walking, and it's like Yeah, they could have done more to cover up the, the like where the head is like clearly the top of somebody's head where like they're like, I think they put like a necklace over it to be like, that's what that is. That's not a bulge of the top of someone's head.
Yeah. What's that that movie that just came out with that clearly drew a lot of inspiration?
Oh, Malignant?
There you go. Yes.
Yeah.
There is so many parallels here.
I was thinking Malignant when they showed the back of Foster Sutton Kane's like head, and it's like that crazy mutant creature behind him.
The spider walking too, you know. It's I don't know, spider walking does nothing for me. It's the it takes me right out of the movie, and it's hilarious every time I see it.
I don't know, the first time I watched The Exorcist, I got a hold of the unrated director's cut or whatever, and I watched it at, like, in the middle of the night at home, no one was awake, and the crab walk scene scared the shit out of me, honestly.
But that's the problem, is that was so good that everyone tried to do it again and no one could do it well.
All I see are strings now, you know. You could just see everything. You know that's a person, you know. I don't know. I agree with you on The Exorcist. I think that one's done really, really well. But
no, it's like in the Mouth of Madness crab walk to The Exorcist crab walk is kind of like Nirvana to the Toadies. You know what I mean? Like, it's like, it's a good effort. It's just not Nirvana. Like, I would argue, like, John Carpenter in general as a director, right? Like, I think he's usually more of a, like, not showing his hands very often, right? Like, his movies are, like, pretty slow paced and, like, kind of build up steam. And, you know, like, Halloween, like, you barely see any of the violence in Halloween. Yeah. It's all implied violence. And, you know, this is like around that era, like, it's like right after The Thing, he's like starting to get like more into the practical effects. But even The Thing, it's a slow burn before you start getting to the craziness. This movie wastes like maybe 15 minutes, and then it's just like, all right, now we're in crazy town. Have fun for the next hour.
Did you not catch the name of the film?
That is true.
I think even touching on the soundtrack, you know, switching from the electronic keyboard to this straight up driving metal, you know, I think right from the get-go he's saying this is kind of a different movie here that we're playing. But
I mean, good for him. Good for him for branching out.
Yeah, you know what, and I remember someone told me this one time, and I do truly believe this in my heart. They're like, you can hate some John Carpenter movies, you can be like, you know, Ghost of Mars is trash, John Carpenter's Vampires isn't a good movie, but he was like, you know what's the one thing that you can say about John Carpenter? John Carpenter never made a movie that John Carpenter didn't want to watch. Like,
I will defend Big Trouble in Little China.
Oh, I think that might be my favorite of all his movies, to be honest.
Big Trouble in Little China. That movie is so popular now.
It's such a, but I think it's, for me, like, I always liked that movie as a kid, but then as an adult, when you realize that it's like, oh, we're following the sidekick, he just doesn't realize he's the sidekick, is like the best subversion to like the action genre. It's so good.
Yes. Oh, I love that movie.
Nate, I want to ask why this movie? Like, you mentioned that you hadn't watched it in a really long time, but you pretty much, I think I had asked you to be on the show, and you're like, give me an hour. And then you were like, I would really like to talk about In the Mouth of Madness.
Yeah.
But here's two other options.
So this movie, when I was growing up, my cousins really sold this movie to me. And so I went in, I loved John Carpenter. I loved being scared. And I went into this movie like eyes wide open, ready to be terrified. And I had such a fun time watching it the first time. And, you know, I was a little scared. Well, now flash forward a couple months. And I got to tell you a little story here. I'm driving home. I used to come home from work at like 1 a.m. And I'm driving home on this dirt road. And this is in, you know, middle of the mountains, Utah. So I'm driving on this dirt road and I see a person up ahead of me. It's this girl riding a bike with blonde hair that's flowing out behind her, right? And I got terrified. I'm not kidding at all. I got terrified. Sped past her like 60 miles an hour, realized she was one of my friends. I was driving too fast. I get home and my heart's beating like 30. You know, it's like 300 miles an hour. You know, I'm terrified of what I just seen, even though I know it's my friend. So of all the movies I've watched, just because of that one old man kid part on the bike, I've always hung on to this movie because I was scared as a kid. I really just enjoy it, man. And beyond that, I really like how meta it gets. I wanted to see this movie fold in on itself. You know, I'd love if Sam Neill came out as Sam Neill. I just wanted more. I really like the idea of it being meta. I wanted this to turn into like a black hole movie where it just swallows itself and comes out inside out. You know what I mean? I just... I really enjoy this movie. I just love it.
You threw the word fun out there, and I really do think it is, like, as heady as the movie is, it never stops at least having fun with what it's doing. It's not too invested in its own bullshit to, like, not be able to, like, wink, smile, and nod about the absurdity of it all at the same time.
Yes, and I'm okay with all the leaps in logic, you know, and that, because you kind of have to piece the plot together by the end, you know, and that's okay. it's a lot of fun. Like, the scenes, getting from scene to scene is fun, and I just enjoy it, man. I really love this movie.
And even, like, something as horrifying as, like, when he's watching that dude kill himself with a shotgun, and he's like, please don't do it, and he's like, I have to, I was written this way. Like, it's like shit like that's like, it's kind of like that movie Stranger Than Fiction, but so much more horrific, because you're sitting there and you're like, they are super sentient, that they are characters, and that they cannot deviate from their plot. Like,
by the way, Viggo the Carpathian,
this is his last movie before he died.
That's wild. Every time I see him, I'm like, it's Viggo. That's awesome.
No, you have to do the voice. You have to be like, oh, it's Viggo.
Even, like, the jump scares in this are really well paced. Like, there's that scene where Sam Neill has the nightmare, and then he just turns around and there's, like, that mutant cop sitting next to him for a split second. It's like, shit, that even got me for a second.
Yeah,
like,
I get so annoyed to get caught by the devil nightmares, you know? Like, come on, Nate, what's wrong with you?
Like, even stuff like, I've watched Jaws 100 times. 100 times. And I still jump at the same part every single time, when the boat's going down and Chief Brody's in the water. And I'm like, at some point the shark bursts through this glass, but I never remember the exact moment that it happens. So I'm like anticipating. And then every time it still startles me when that head just smashes through the side of the boat.
Mulholland Drive, the monster behind the diner every single time. Not that I'm rewatching Mulholland Drive all the time. But.
You don't have
that old revisitable classic.
Yeah.
You mentioned Mulholland Drive. I'm going to go down a tangent that is, like, one of my favorite stories. So I was in high school. I was in a film class.
Ooh.
One of our assignments was to make a music video. I did an all claymation music video, which took fucking months to do.
Of course,
obviously, when we're done the music video session, we all sit in class and we watch these music videos, right? One of the kids' music videos was a 9-minute long Tool song that he just filmed his TV as Mulholland Drive was on. And it was just like, like highlights from Mulholland Drive. And then at one point he was like playing a video game. And like, our teacher was like infamously short-tempered as a person. So there's a point about 5 minutes into this shit music video where like slowly all of the eyes of the class are like turning to look at the teacher to see like what is about to happen.
Yeah.
And he sees that everyone's looking at him and he just goes, oh, I know. But he made this, so we all have to suffer now.
And I'm going to say, I think Tool matches perfectly with that shit. Right? That is a video. They would be like, yeah, I like it. Let's do it.
Yeah, let's just film the TV.
Tool has either great songs or just straight garbage, you know, and there's like, that's all they have, you know.
I feel like that's Maynard's MO in general, because I can say the same about Perfect Circle and all of his other projects.
I completely agree with that. Yes, a 9-minute video of Mulholland Drive in a 11th grade English class. That's exactly how I would picture one of their videos.
Anyway, sorry, back to In the Mouth of Bed.
A tangent movie.
Well, this whole movie is a tangent, really.
You know, it's one tangent after another.
The best part about, I did some reading about the allegories and the hat tips that they were doing, more or less, between Stephen King and H.P. Lovecraft, and no one agrees. Everybody's like, no, this is a Stephen King reference, and then somebody else is like, no, this is a Lovecraft reference, and then somebody else is like, you're both wrong. It's not a reference at all. This movie is the most gatekeepy movie.
Then there's
it's
the
hilarious.
One guy that's like, I think it's a reference to Dean Koontz.
I know,
and that's like, literally Dean Koontz on IMDb putting in the trivia.
Yeah, hey guys, is it Dean Koontz? Great. Honestly. Username not Dean Koontz.
Yeah, at definitely not Dean K.
Yeah. DeanKuntz's mom.com. Yes. Honestly, I could see Clive Barker oozing into this a little bit. This is more his style, but
Clive Barker is really, really heavily. I think that he's far more influenced by the Cthulhu mythos than Stephen King. Although I understand that Stephen King's earliest, some of his earliest work, is considered to be part of the Cthulhu mythos. I just find that Clive Barker has a lot more of his short stories, and Clive Barker is a much better short story writer than Stephen King, because I feel like Stephen King, I mean, I love Night Shift and I love Skeleton Key. Those are what I would consider my favorite Stephen King releases, or, you know, like of the things he's published, I love his short stories the best. Because I think that horror works best as short stories. I've had a really hard time as an adult finding full length novels in the horror genre that don't piss me off, because it feels
it's
like
basically just the John Dies at the End trilogy for you, and not much else.
I mean, but also J-Date works so much better because it is almost episodic.
Well, and I think that that's something that we've talked about before, is the idea that the person who writes those books is a comedy writer first. We are seeing the last 10 years, we have seen that comedy writers are better at writing horror than most people who've dedicated their life to writing horror. And Nate, I'd love to hear your two cents on this, but I know for me, I think it's that the setup to a joke is very similar to the setup of a scare. Like, you have to know it.
Right. You're just going for beat, beat, punchline, right? It's the same thing, right?
And sometimes the punchline is being stabbed.
Yeah.
You know, and I do think that comedy writers tend to understand the idea of heightening a little bit more than regular writers, right? So it's really easy to give a taste and then give another taste, wait a beat, give that punchline, right? It's the same writing for everything. I think that's why, like, a lot of times Stephen King, I don't even really kind of put him in the horror genre sometimes. The Stand is not a horror book to me, you know? Langoliers is not horror. To me, it's almost like a thriller fiction than anything. I think his horror comes from his short stories, like you were saying, you know? And I do think that once he gets longer and more verbose, he loses the horror aspect, which is, I think, interesting.
Well, I also think that, like, if I was to rank my top five Stephen King books, I don't think any of them would fall into the horror genre. No. Like, I think, he likes horror, but I think that that's not his strong suit.
I agree.
But it's what sells. So he's like, all right, I'm just going to keep writing it.
I think his longest straight horror book might be, like, The Regulators, but he wrote that under Bachman.
So The Regulators and Desperation, I would consider that one book.
Yeah.
It's kind of like how I would consider Dolores Claiborne and Gerald's Game one book.
Misery can be thrown into that little pile.
Oh, yeah, because they actually, you're right. All three of those are supernaturally connected and they happen at the same time. So I really do think that the horror of Stephen King's writing, in Stephen King's writing, comes from drama. The things that happen aren't necessarily terrifying. The things that happen are horrifying because he builds so much into those characters. And I have always gravitated, ever since the first time I read Edgar Allan Poe. Like, I've always been a short story kind of person because I want that dopamine rush, you know? Like, I want to be a little scared. I want there to be enough holes left in what that monster or that killer or that experience, that horrific experience is, that I can fill in the blanks myself. Yep. No one's going to scare you as well as your own brain.
Yep.
And the buildup is so long that when things happen, it's like, I mean, I really think of him more of like the EC Comics kind of, because he was so heavily influenced by them. I mean, obviously because he did Creepshow. Yeah. But I think about some of the stuff he did as Bachman, like Roadwork. I would consider a lot of it revenge porn, you know, kind of like that. I agree with both of you that he's less of like a straight horror writer. The themes are horror, but the presentation is not.
I think that you made a good point bringing up EC Comics, though, because I think he also falls into this category where, like, something else that I think gets categorized as horror more often than it actually is horror is that I think his books are very comparable to, like, Twilight Zone episodes.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, the Twilight Zone episodes, it's a lot more of, like, a sense of dread in this fantastical alternate reality than our own, than anything else.
Existential, yeah.
Yeah, but, like, people talk about Twilight Zone, and if you're listening to the way people talk about the Twilight Zone, you're thinking that you're going to watch a show that's going to literally scare the shit out of you. But it's like, no, it's much more headier than that. And it's more like the concept of the world that you're in is very upsetting on an emotional level more than anything.
Yeah, with his, again, we're going back to his word count. I think his word count is his biggest weakness. When you look at how many words he puts into his book, he ends up spending a weirdly disproportionate amount of time explaining the why behind how things happen.
He's like Tolkien.
Your point. Yeah, I hate that. I don't want the why, because when you get into the why, you get really silly reasons. Why are these monsters living in the middle of the earth, right? For mathematics, like, why? I don't care. I like to come up with earth. You know, I think that scares me.
That's what's so funny. Like, when you compare what Stephen King does to what Lovecraft did, Lovecraft did the exact opposite, where there would be just little flashes of an explanation of the visual of a monster. But most of the time, it was like the monster was so horrific that it turned the person who saw it mad. And that's, you know, like, there's no rhyme or reason why. There's no motive for the elder gods that want to take over the world. Like, Sutter Kane in this is just doing it because he can. You know?
Yeah.
Like,
it's, I agree with that.
And that's the only why that you need.
I love that. Yep, I totally love it. It reminds me of, like, this is going to be a weird pull, but Raiders of the Lost Ark, you know? Why did the Ark kill all the Nazis? Well, why not, you know?
Because it's just something from another world, you know?
Yeah,
like, it doesn't care about humans. We're ants.
And I want to, as we're getting close to, I think, the end of the Mouth of Madness, Nate's obviously, he doesn't know this, but I'm about to tell him. He's about to join us for our Patreon episode, and I figured out what the Patreon episode is going to be on this Stephen King tangent, is that I've been pitching an idea to our co-host Kyle of a documentary I want to make about Stephen King, and I'm going to pitch it to you guys as our Patreon episode. So you can fill in the blanks. But we do have to, at least real quick before we wrap up in the Mouth of Madness, talk about the most gif-able ending of the movie, of just Sam Neill just sitting laughing in the movie theater. I've seen that pop up in comments on Slack threads and Discord many a times. It's right there with Michael Jackson eating the popcorn. Is just if you like classic great final shot that literally, like you said, Nate, like, the movie's just kind of folding in on itself, and it's like it's making you feel insane while watching it. Like, it's such a crazy ending.
They really blend it there between, you know, this Dr. or John Trent, who, by the way, insurance investigator. Holy crap, what a weird job. Anyways, I really like that touch, because that's such a weird private investigator, like, a niche right there. I loved it.
Hey man, there's riches and niches.
So having Trent kind of meld with Sam Neill there at the end a little bit, I loved that. I really loved this movie tried to turn itself inside out. I think that was such a smart play. But yes, I love him sitting in the theater just laugh. It's a kind of a seminal image from the movie. I really enjoy it.
Just covered with all the drawn on crosses and shit.
He had a lot of shit on his face this movie.
All right, well, I think we're at the point where we're going to talk about some double features. Nate, I don't know if I gave you a heads up on this either, but
that's all right.
Maybe Bacon did. At the end of every episode, we pick another film that we would want to pair with this movie. It could be because it's very similar aesthetically. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's something as loose as, hey, the same actors in both of these movies, so it makes me want to watch it. But to give you a little bit of time to think of something, Scott, how about you tell us your double feature for In the Mouth of Madness?
It's more of a bit than an actual double feature, but you know, you get done with In the Mouth of Madness, and I turn to the person that I've subjected to the watch, and I go, "Do you like Sutter Kane?" And then we put on Disturbing Behavior.
All right, fair enough. I'm into that bit. I was watching the movie, and I was thinking, man, there's another movie that I really love where a slightly older gentleman is on a road trip to solve a mystery with a much younger woman, and there's implications of some romantic ties. So I'm going to pop on Halloween 3, Season of the Witch, immediately following In the Mouth.
I don't think the implication is there. That movie is just about the banging.
You know what? I think I've already given it out earlier. And Malignant. Yeah, I think you should pair both of these. It's a lot of gore, and it's a lot of stupid horror. But I don't know. It's like watching a dad and his junior. Don't get me wrong. I don't think I'd enjoy this double feature. I do think they pair well together. I don't know. I think it'd be an interesting night to at least talk over and just seeing exactly what.
Well, you could
off.
Do what you were talking about with 11/22/63, where you watch the first 10 minutes and then the last 10 minutes of Malignant, and you get the entire movie.
You do. Yeah, you really do. Okay, I changed my answer. The first 10 minutes and the last 10 minutes of Malignant. That's what I would do. You got to see them pull all this stuff, where it came from. I think that's interesting.
All right, and for the last part of the show, we talk about what is something that we've watched, read, whatever, that we either really, really loved or we'd like to warn people to avoid at all costs. Scott, we'll start with you again.
I've been sitting on it. It's been probably 2 months since I finished it at this point, but I finally watched Dr. Sleep, and I thought that this would be a great time to mention that I did finally, since it dovetails with all the Stephen King talk that we've done this week. Mm-hmm. I really enjoyed it, but only because of Ewan McGregor.
He's such a fantastic actor.
Yeah, he's just, I've never seen a bad Ewan McGregor performance. Yep. I'm sure I've seen bad Ewan McGregor movies, but not a bad Ewan McGregor performance. I would say that the genius of Mike Flanagan, and I would never really give him this kind of credit like regularly, but I think that he really deserves it. I mean, like, Mike Flanagan is very hit or miss is what I'm trying to say. But
yes.
Yeah.
This is a straight hit. This is a home run in the way that he brought in, especially the visual aesthetic of Stanley Kubrick's The Shining. As much as I dislike that movie as a novel adaptation, I think that it's an important piece of cinema. You know?
Yeah, so,
and I think that Dr. Sleep is a Stephen King book as a movie that has a little sprinkling of, you know, like that spice from The Shining. And I think it blends so well, where Stanley Kubrick just couldn't get out of his own head to blend it himself. Yep. So I think that's truly a piece of art there.
I'm going to talk about something that is going to feel real awkwardly dated by the time this episode comes out.
Then don't do it.
January. No, I got to do it because I need to tell people how good this movie was. Last night, me and my friends hopped on HBO Max and we watched 8-Bit Christmas, which is a new film that is basically a modern day version of The Christmas Story, except instead of wanting a BB gun, he really wants an NES. It is so heartfelt. It's such a sweet movie. Oh, it's really funny. It exists in like child logic, where like the school bully is played by like a 40-year-old man surrounded by a bunch of like 10-year-olds. Like, it's like little stuff like that that's like so fucking funny and tied into like nostalgia and childhood innocence that like, yeah, obviously you're probably going to want to watch it in like late November, early December, but it taps on so much of like those things that you remember as a kid that I think, you know, it's January. If you're in an area where it's snowy, I think you would still pull a lot from it that you'd be like, all right, this feels okay enough for a January watch. But finally, Nate, what is something that you watch, listen to, whatever, that you want to promote? And also, tell us about 91 Donkey Lane.
Yes, I will. So the thing I would like to promote might be a little stale at this point as well, but I want people to watch it, is Pig. I think Pig was the movie I enjoyed the most that came out this year. When you expect it to go left, it goes right. When you expect it to go up, it goes down. Nick Cage is fantastic in it, and it is not what you think it is. It's not a John Wick movie. It is so good. I absolutely adored that movie. So go watch Pig. Watch it with friends. It's a really good party movie, I think. And then 91 Donkey Lane. It's a podcast we've been going, I can't believe, almost 3 years now.
Yeah.
It's my roommate and I, we do a fully improvised, basically, radio play, I guess, at this point.
Yeah.
It's about a 20-25 minute long comedy podcast. We play two heightened versions of ourselves. We're idiots. We live in a magical apartment. We get visited by magical creatures and ghosts and whatever else you want. It's just a fun time. It's really great. This latest episode, Bacon is out of jail now. We are trying to get ghosts out of our house, and of course we fuck it all up because we're morons. So it's a lot of fun.
And I mean, you guys are very close to your 25th episode spectacular. So like, that's really cool too.
You know how that started? That was the fifth episode. I was talking too fast and I said our first fifth episode spectacular. Bacon, because he doesn't miss anything, he's like, okay, well, now we're doing one every five episodes. That's how it started.
Just such a funny show. So many classic moments. I know the seance, at the time we're recording this, the seance episode's the most recent episode.
Yes.
And it was just absolute. I was fucking dying listening to Bacon have to voicing like 10 different ghosts. And I'm bringing it up because Bacon 100% does one of them as Bob from House by the Cemetery.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Oh, God, it's so funny. I don't know why. Our comedy works when I win and he loses. And it's so funny every time it happens. I just adore it because I can do whatever I want and I always win and I love it.
All right. Well, Nate, thank you so much for joining us. Everyone, go check out 91 Donkey Lane.
Yes, please.
Keep subscribing and writing those reviews and five stars and all that good jazz on Horror Movie Night and 91 Donkey Lane. Toss them some five stars too. And we will be back next week with more Horror Movie Night.
You're listening to the Geekscape Network.